Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. Autumn semester 2009, this is Business Finance FIL 240, Section 6. Lecture 3, delivered on August 25, 2009. The title of this lecture is Financial Markets.
Today, financial markets. This will include a brief discussion of interest rates. And it will also include one of your first chances to actually put your hands on a problem and do some calculation. So I trust that you have a calculator or access to someone who has one, because it's not hard, really. What I'm going to do here now is like a first shot at calculating a yield on a security. Very simple security, but it gives you all of the most important concepts in doing work that would be more complicated later, to convince you that when it looks more complicated, it really isn't that much more complicated, because the essential principles are going to be the same. But I've got a main principal point that I'm going to make with this calculation today. In fact, there will be two. The topic begins with a somewhat diffuse concept. The idea of economic units. And the book does this as well as you can expect, but I do want to make a little bit of a correction to what the book is saying. Surplus economic units versus deficit economic units. Now, a surplus economic unit has more cash flow than its obligations require. In other words, the cash inflow exceeds the cash outflow at a given point in time. I should point this out, and that's going to be a little bit important here in a minute. A deficit economic unit as it says, a deficit of cash flow. It has more cash outflow than it has cash inflow at some point in time. Now, the way financial markets work is to provide intermediary services that will match up the surplus with the deficit. Here's the thing about it, though. It's a little more complicated. I understand the book doesn't want to get into the really weird nuance of it, but you could actually have surplus economic units at one point in time, but at another point in time, you could have deficit economic units. In fact, at the same time, you could have surplus economic units and deficit economic units. For example, your immediate cash flow situation might put you in a deficit situation. But over the long term, you might have surplus economic units. So you might need cash right now to cover current obligations, but you've got plenty for the future. And that's one of the important parts about a sound financial system, is that essentially we would not provide deficit economic units with surplus economic units unless we were pretty sure that those deficit economic units were going to have surplus in the future to satisfy obligations. So you could borrow on, let's say, a mortgage. You could borrow the money to get a house. In that context, you just don't have $200,000. But over the life of your productive life, you'll have more than enough to be able to pay off a $200,000 loan. We just want to make sure that that's the way it's going to work. So getting that kind of that complication out of the way, the financial markets solve this imbalance between surpluses and deficits at any given point in time through what we call financial intermediaries. Financial intermediaries are of quite a few different kinds. Now, in this class, we are going to talk about the official ones. But there are, you know, I heard that you needed $100. I heard that he had, you know, can you, you know, work? She needs $100. Okay, she's going to pay you, you know, like $10 of interest if you pay her back tomorrow. But there's an informal intermediary market. Here we're talking more about the formal intermediary markets. Now, the book focuses on investment bankers. And I want to make absolutely sure you know that they are not the only financial intermediaries out there. Banks, savings and loans, credit unions are financial intermediaries, most decidedly. This isn't just about the world of stocks and bonds. This is about any kind of need to match up surplus and deficit economic units. So when we talk about investment bankers in this class, that's more in the world of business and government and kinds of borrowing. But in personal markets, there are, in private household markets, there are financial intermediaries that are hooking up banks who have depositors' money with people who need home loans, car loans, credit card debt, and all that kind of stuff. So in this class, though, we will focus on the investment bankers and those kinds of people. Now, I'm going to bring up some terminology here. We use this all the time, or at least people who are a little more professional use these words all the time, but I have to tighten the screws on the meaning of them in finance. You might even hear me slip sometimes and go back to more common terminology, but really, I got to show you what these really mean. The three words are broker, agent, and dealer. Interestingly, I won't keep harping on the text, but there's a place early on in the text where the author says, a broker is an agent who, no, wait a minute, you're either a broker or an agent. You are not both. As a matter of fact, in many states, there are laws that prevent you from being both in a given transaction. Look, a broker represents the buyer in a transaction. It could be a transaction for a physical good or a financial good or some kind of service. An agent represents the seller. A dealer represents himself or herself. There you go. Now, so if you go, you see a house for sale. You see a realtor sign. So you call up that realtor. And this is, let's say, Acme Real Estate Agency. Acme Real Estate Agency. You say, I saw a house. I should like to buy that house. Well, we're going to work for you. What do you know? Is that correct? If it's an agent and you called to talk about a house that you saw with that is listed through that agency, is it? Tell me. No, it's not. Because that agent represents the seller of the house. An agent represents the seller of a house, not you as a buyer. So let's go to another one. Okay, now, when you buy stock, someday you're going to work, you're going to be a top exec, okay, you're going to be an intermediate executive at State Barn. And you're going to have surplus economic units, and you're going to say, well, I need to get myself, I want to buy some stocks. So you set up an account with a brokerage, a stock brokerage agency, I almost said, a stock brokerage. So when you put in orders with that broker, who's he representing?
Me.
Bingo. He is representing you because he represents the buyer. He'll go out there and get you his best price. That's what his obligation is under the legal concept of broker. He will represent you, consistent with law and the regulatory framework in which he operates in his market. Okay, now, car dealer. I'm on your side. I'll get you the car because I'm on your side. I'm a car dealer. What say you?
No.
No. Bull. Horse hockey. You know, to use some technical terminology here. That's exactly right. He's a dealer. He represents his own ass. He is not there for you. He is not there except for himself. He will buy inventory, and then he will sell that inventory. He is in it for himself. So now we can talk about, and I'm slipping ahead. You'll see me do this a lot. I kind of jump ahead, build a concept, and then step back, and then when we come through it, it looks a little bit more sensical. When you're talking about stocks and buying them on the fixed exchanges, the actual physical exchange platforms, you can have runners who represent brokers. Someone gets a phone call, okay? I've got a phone call. You have put in an order for 1,000 shares of Microsoft. Why you would do that, I have no idea. Are you nuts? Oh, anyway, you put in 1,000 shares. I shouldn't say that. It's great, great investment. Damn great investment, Bill Gates. But you put in an order with your broker. He puts the order to the floor. The floor gets some guy at the edge of the floor gets the order, and he either runs out there or he essentially can send signals. There's a whole world, a whole language of symbols. And it actually has to change all the time so that your signaling system with your people can't be read by another group's signaling system. So it's all the time it's changing. In my day, I could do it really well, but now I wouldn't know what they're saying in a lot of cases because of the language of the hands and the faces. I mean, sometimes it looks like they're having spasms. It's like in baseball. You see those hand signals in baseball. This is worlds more complicated than that. But he'll do something to signal, okay, I need this bought. Best price. He is representing you. There is a broker and his people who are actually there doing your bidding. They are there for you. I mean, if you're small potatoes or, you know, meh. But in any case, and I shouldn't have used Microsoft as the example, but in any case, he's going to run out there onto the floor and he is going to probably, he might find a broker. Some other broker who's working that stock, who's got some of it to sell, they'll work through. Remember that the other guy is working for his clients, your guy's working for you, and they're going to have some kind of a negotiation that is going to last maybe just a few seconds perhaps, and they'll work it out. If he can't get enough stock from that guy, he'll get some from the one that he was working with, then he'll go and find someone else to do it with. But he might, given what exchange it is, he might actually go to a station where there is a dealer. On some of the exchanges, there's actually people who are there, who are given the right by the exchange to be there, who are dealers. They buy their own inventory and they stand there all day long waiting for people to come up to them and scream orders. And they argue and they negotiate. They look up at the screens to see what this dealer is offering, what's up there. And that dealer is smart. He's there for his own coin. The dealer on an exchange is a special bird. Brilliant, fast, probably hyped up on caffeine. In the old days, they used to hype up on other more powerful things, but that was another time. Seriously, and I mean, when I was stepping into that world, and I did not get into it too heavily, I mean, Coke was heavy, but the Coke made the guys too wired, so what they started doing, and this was in my time, they started cutting it with a little bit of a sedative called heroin, and that got them so that they were able to function, and it was quite a time back then. God, I miss it. It's a lot calmer now on the exchanges, but it's still, I mean, what's funny is if some of you have probably seen exchanges. Did any of you ever see the movie Trading Places? Great movie. I love the movie. But they're really, I mean, that's not even close to how insane it gets. And it looks like there's no logic at all. It's just total chaos. No, it is so logical, so ordered. It is creepy. Just this mass herd of individual agents operating on their own for their own interests, each one operating for some interest. And it works. It works beautifully. But from the outside, it is absolutely scary to see. How in the world are you supposed to function in this environment? They're yelling. They got better rules now. It used to be, you know, people could use physical, get physical. Now they don't let them do that kind of stuff, but it still looks crazy. But anyway, okay. The idea, though, is that I'm just giving you sort of the concepts here. Let me bring one more interesting one up. Because this is the Department of Finance, Insurance, and Law, I should bring up that normally when you buy insurance, do you have insurance? Cars, yeah, car insurance. Okay, you've got that car insurance through an agent, I will bet, right? So who is that car insurance company? Who is that agent representing?
Me.
No, that's an agent.
Oh, that's right.
You're buying insurance.
Oh, so themselves. Yeah.
Not themselves. They're not a dealer.
Well, who
they're representing the insurance company that's selling the product. That's what an insurance agent does. It represents probably more than one, maybe not, but some agents, the independent agents, they might represent more than one company, but they'll step out into that market for on behalf of the insurance companies, the carriers, as we call them. It could be something like AIG, Cincinnati, Zurich, whatever, State Barn, Allstate. Those people are representing the company. When you come to them, always know they represent the company. Now, is that the way all insurance is? Absolutely not. When you're in the big league, and I had a very, very close friend who was in this for some time, there is a world of insurance that is what we would call commercial lines, but it's not most commercial lines. It's through an agency. But if you're a huge company, you don't go through an insurance agent. You go through an insurance broker. And in the old days, we called them the alphabet houses. There was Marsh & McLellan, Alexander & Alexander. There were all of these brokerage houses. And these cats represented the company that needed insurance, and they went to the big insurance companies, and they worked on behalf of their client. Like, for example, Wendy's International needs insurance. They go through they would go through an alphabet house. The alphabet house would have several layers in it. There would be the biggest top dog. He's called a producer. The producer was the liaison who actually was like the insurance salesman, worked with, in this case, Wendy's International. Below him was the account executive. Now, the account executive was probably going to be the one who negotiated, did the line level negotiation, the underwriting negotiation with the insurance companies. Essentially, that account executive would go out to a bunch of insurance companies and say, I've got this client, needs this. Make bids on this business. And whoever did the best as far as the lowest prices, the best coverages, got the business. But it was for Wendy's International. They were working, not for those insurance companies. Those insurance companies had to bark for their business. They had to offer the product. So at that level, you're talking about, by the way, insurance producers, they're still around. They are very well paid. You live, if you build a book of business, it's like you are a very comfortable person. I knew some of those people. They were just very consummate, smart. I shouldn't say that. The account executives said the producers were nothing but pretty boys. It was also a very sexist business back in the time I knew about it. You didn't see hardly any female producers. Account executives, yeah, you saw females because they were the technical experts. They knew how to negotiate the contracts, the underwriting agreements, and all that kind of stuff. But that's but it's even at the account executive level, they were paid pretty darn well. But I mean, those producers, those essentially glorified insurance salesmen, boy, were they paid well. And they still are to this day, but it's a rarefied world. You have to work your way up from the lowest levels and then work your way up through the account executive, and eventually maybe they'll let you try, do one or two on your own producing, and then you get fully into production, and then the world is yours. You're traveling all over and making negotiations with companies to get their business, and then you send it to the account executive and say, handle it. And then the account executive says, oh my God, this is complicated. And then goes out and gets bids, sets it up, says this is what we need, this is the insurance package that I would like to see, bid on it. That's enough about that. But I wanted to convey this concept of the distinction between broker, agent, and dealer. And sometimes you'll even hear me kind of blur, especially broker versus agent. You'll hear me call it an agent, and it's really a broker. Okay, now, when we get to financial intermediaries, returning to financial intermediaries, like I said in this course, I will spend a little bit of time on the financial intermediaries called investment bankers. Investment bankers essentially are one means by which surplus and deficit economic units can come together. And the investment banker, essentially, if there is a deficit in, say, a company, we need money. The investment banker works with the company to design a financial product, a security. Remember what I said about a security last week? A security that will meet the company's needs. Now, that security has to have the proper obligations. It can't kill the company in terms of repayment. It has to, in a lot of ways, match the needs in terms of the timing of the cash flows in, cash flows out. So in other words, if a company needs money for a long-term capital project, an investment banker would certainly not recommend some very short-term product like commercial paper. And on the other hand, if the company just needs working capital, certainly an investment banker isn't going to recommend a security that is like common stock, which lasts forever. Okay, now, when an investment banker prepares a security with the work of the company to sell into the market, to raise money for the company by bringing surplus units to the needs of this deficit economic unit, there are two ways that it can do it. It can do it through a best efforts offering, which were the ones that I specialized in with the broker dealers that I worked with. And then there are actually just the underwriting offerings, underwritten offerings. Now, an underwriting is essentially where the investment banker prepares the product that will be sold by the corporate client and then basically buys up the security and then sells the security out into the open markets. These are glorious. I always dreamed of having one of these actually happen. Never did for me, but it would be wonderful. It's wonderful. Essentially, the investment banker works out, okay, we're going to sell 1 million shares of common stock, and we are going to sell them at $10 a share. Okay, that would mean $10 million. The company's not going to get $10 million. It's going to have all these fees taken out and all that by the investment banker. The banker's not stupid. But after that, the banker simply ships the money to the company that sold the stock. And the company is good with the whole thing then. And then the investment banker goes out and sells the stock. It will pump the stock. It will find all the different possible angles by which to sell this stock. But, and of course, if the price goes up, hey, the investment banker is doing pretty well in this kind of a deal because it has essentially already bought the stock. So its job at this point is to get that stock sold for its own account. So in a sense, notice something, that the investment banker first is an agent representing the seller being the company that's issuing the stock. But then if it's an underwritten offering, that investment banker somewhere along the line becomes the dealer for its own account on that stock. Now, a Western style offering, I'm using old terminology the book doesn't use. A best efforts offering, essentially, the investment banker says, we'll try our best. Okay? A lot of times I would design, as a consultant for the company, I would design the security, say common stock, 1 million shares at 50 cents a share. Yeah, it was that bad. I did the penny stock two-step, 50 cents a share. And you would get these. I would find some lead broker-dealer who would agree to try to sell it to his clients through his people. Hence the boiler rooms. That's where I didn't work in the boiler rooms, although I've had students who have. But essentially, they would try to sell my stock for me. Now, in either of these cases, you will have what is called a syndicate. I hope to God you'll have a syndicate. That is a system of broker dealers who are out there. They've agreed to take on a portion of the sale of the security. Now, in a best efforts offering, you've got the syndicate. Each one tries its best. Each broker dealer in the syndicate for the offering tries its best to do its portion. Like there was one syndicate that I had for a company out in California. It was actually a 1 million share offering, 50 cents a share. And the lead broker dealer, the one that I had the good relationship with, he had set it up so that he would handle 60% of the offering. And then he had four other broker dealers, two in New York, one in Washington and one in California, who would handle an equal portion of the rest of the securities, try to sell it through their people to their clients. Didn't work out, fell apart, didn't hardly ever work out. Only twice in the many times I tried did a best efforts offering ever actually succeed. We fell short every time, of most of the time. Now, in an underwritten offering, of course, the syndicate, the underwriter has already agreed, I'm going to buy this. But his syndicate is also in the agreement that they are buying too. So they're acting in unison. After the security has been bought, they're all going to be dealers. They each get their portion of the pie. They've each paid their share of the offering price. And then they go out in their syndicate and unload the stock to the extent that they want to. Now, they don't always sell all of the stock, by the way. They might keep some for their own investment purposes. It's dicey. It's a complicated game. Look, if you dump all that stock right away, the whole syndicate's unloading all of its stock, well, that's going to knock the price out down. So you might not see all of that stock just suddenly flood the market. It might be timed out so that it keeps the price going up. Good news, press releases come out. Positive things are said about the company by shills in the news media who pretend that they're not shills in the news media. People like Cramer. You know the story of Mr. Cramer, the guy who was CNBC's point man, got his ass ripped by Jon Stewart, a comedian, because Cramer had been such a nasty son of a bitch doing this stuff long ago, and there were recordings of how he used to do this stuff. Okay, enough of that. What I'm describing to you is a primary market where a company sells a security and gets the proceeds of the sale. Where a company, that is a primary market, where a company actually gets the proceeds of the sale of a security, a stock, a bond, or whatever, commercial paper, whatever. That's a primary market. The issuer of the security is the recipient of the cash inflow from the sale of the security. Primary markets. IPOs, SPOs, secondary public offerings. Well, after the first initial offering, a company might sell stock later. Sometimes they sell it in chunks, or sometimes they just kind of dribble it out. There's something called a shelf registration big companies can do. But these are primary market sales. The company gets the money, or at least some of it. On the other hand, there is the secondary market. This is where securities are sold among investors. Now, those investors could be companies, people, other kinds of financial organizations or groups. The company doesn't see any money from this kind of activity. This is enormous, voluminous beyond belief, trillions of dollars, quadrillions of trades, just masses of trades. I remember once, one of the things that I would do is I would get companies listed on exchanges. And sometimes relisted. A company would fall off an exchange because it didn't do its filings on time. And other times there was a trick that was big in my time called reverse mergers into dead public shells, where a private company would buy a dead public company and then it could come back to life, and it would have already, the dead public company was already essentially a public company, so it didn't have to go through a lot of the initial filings to become a public company. Well, we could do that all the time back in my day. But then, of course, that didn't really mean anything unless you got the stock relisted on an exchange, because you wanted the stock to be actively tradable so investors who had stock could sell it and people who wanted to buy stock could buy it. Well, I got this company listed, relisted on the OTC, and the president of the company, he was just thrilled the day that it came back up. It was actually listed and you could see its listing. And he said, well, when do I get the money? Well, what do you mean, what money? Well, yeah, it's listed. Well, you know, when's the money going to start coming in? He was furious with me because he thought that somehow all that trading activity that was starting to happen with his stock again, that belonged to the company somehow. No, this is people who've had your stock for a long time who are now so glad that they see it listed, they're selling it, and new investors coming in and buying those securities that have been held for so long by people who thought the company was dead. You don't get any of that money. Oh, he was furious. He threatened to sue me and everything. I mean, he did contact a lawyer, and the lawyer said something to the effect, you dumb friggin' idiot. No, that's getting listed. That's a secondary market. Okay. Now, the secondary market is the market where you're seeing those prices that you see on stock tickers and all that kind of stuff. That's the activity of the buyers and the sellers coming together. When there is more, when the quantity demanded is greater than the quantity supplied, the price will adjust, equilibrium price will rise. And on the other hand, if there are more sellers than buyers, then the price will go down. Now, on the secondary market, you might think, well, the company really shouldn't care about that. And to some extent, no. The company should not be obsessed with stock price. I have known companies that were, and it always worries me when, especially with a small company, when you've got the top executives, well, the stock price is going down. What are you going to do about it? Let's do some press releases. Usually that tells me that those people are playing, they want that stock price up so they can dump some of their stock and get some money. That's really what that was all about. But in general, a company should not be terribly concerned about its stock price from day to day. On a longer-term basis, of course it should be concerned, because those are the owners of the company. The stockholders are the owners of the company. You want to do right by them. Doing right by them means getting their stock price up. Remember the goal of the firm, maximizing the wealth of the shareholders? Well, the problem here is it's hard to wag that dog. I know companies that try to pump out press releases. They try to do all kinds of not-so-good things to try to make the stock price go up. On the other hand, if you just sit there on your fat ass and say, well, we do a good business here and everyone will know that we're a great stock to invest in, no, that's not going to work either, because there are millions of other companies out there that have stock too. You've got to make yourself known, but you've got to make yourself known for the right reasons and at the right times. Here's the thing, though. There's two big reasons, aside from the long-term goal of maximizing wealth of the shareholders, there are two somewhat more immediate reasons to for a company to want its stock price to stay up. One is that you might want to sell stock, some more stock of your company to raise more long-term capital. If the stock price sucks, you're not going to get a whole lot of money for a second sale of securities. So you certainly want your stock price to stay up there so that if you do need to sell more stock down the road, you can, and at a good price. The other reason, which I can speak to personally, is the annual shareholders meeting. If your stock price is low, you're going to have shareholders come to that meeting and they're going to have blood in their eye. They're going to bitch at you. They're going to rip you limb from limb because you have not kept that stock price up there. And let me tell you, that is a grueling thing to go through. And I dreaded some of the companies that I worked with. There was a company that its stock price made it up to like $5 a share, and there was some good news about it. People bought in. Lots of people bought in. And then the company essentially, it didn't do anything. It pushed out stupid press releases that finally irritated the dealers that might have bought, kept our price higher. And, oh, God, the price got down to, it was something like 25 cents a share. Annual shareholders meeting, you had people who were just furious at that meeting. It was one of the worst days of my life. If it hadn't been for the great meal afterwards on the company's expense, I would have hated the whole day. But realistically, though, you want to keep the stock price up. Your main goal, maximize wealth of the shareholders, more immediate. You might need to sell more stock, so you want a high price for the stock so that you can get a good sale. And you don't want a bunch of stupid-ass shareholders eating you alive at the annual shareholders meeting. If it gets bad enough, they could vote the board of directors out, and the board of directors could fire the executives, and the new executives might not want me as their consultant. So I had a very keen interest in this whole thing. That and the fact that, by the way, at that shareholders meeting, the president was up there and he was getting yelled at. And what did that guy do? He looked over at me. I was sitting in this sad little chair and he said, "Well, our consultant here can answer that question." You know, is there like a door, trap door I can fall through here? What do you mean? Anyway, look, let me take this down here. Go on to a few other things. I want to distinguish between the capital markets and the money markets. Money markets are markets for short-term money, for lack of a better term. Money markets are dominated by treasury bills, which are short-term borrowings by the government, 1 year or less, negotiable CDs, certificates of deposit. Commercial paper. Now, commercial paper, when I say commercial paper, that's an odd instrument. Just out of curiosity, I'm assuming that you folks are not completely unaware of the world. You're kind of connected to the world. Have you ever heard of commercial paper? No. It's interesting because it's a huge thing. These are very short-term borrowings by very big credit-worthy corporations. They're as good as cash, or at least they should be. And quick money for something we need to cover $1 million for 30 days. A company would issue just a piece of commercial paper for the purpose. That's what it would do. And this is a huge market, and it's a very thick market. And remember what I said, this would be large, very large, credit worthy corporations would do this. And that's why this is very safe, secure, kind of quick investment for investors who are very well heeled and have a lot of money. Unfortunately, commercial paper can sometimes come out of companies that aren't so good. Enron had a lot of commercial paper out when it went Tap City. Bad news. Hurt the commercial paper market, because that's a market where there's an assurance on the part of the buyers of this paper, the lenders, the surplus economic units, if you will, that this is good, this is as good as gold, this is good stuff. So when you have anyone screw the pooch on a piece of commercial paper, that shakes the investor's confidence in all commercial paper, which drives the yields up because the risk is going up on the paper. So, but it's big stuff. Now, there's one other one in the money markets that I actually had bankers' acceptances. The funny thing was, I went through all of the courses, MBA, PhD in finance, all the coursework, and there were so many holes when I went out there and I started doing my own business as an independent business person, as a consultant, as a broker, as a dealer. And I had never heard of these things. And all of a sudden, I was working trying to set up deals to sell stuff in other countries. Some crap in one country might be gold in another country. You know, you might have medical supplies in a warehouse in Houston. Well, that would be something that would be really, really attractive to sell over in Eastern Europe. After the fall of the Berlin Wall, there were some pretty big holes in their delivery system of goods and services. So I could find things to sell over there that were here no one wanted. There was one bizarre issue. There were maybe 10,000 VHS porn tapes. A great market for it overseas. The market was dying here for that kind of crap because it was in the era when the DVDs were starting to show up. So broker that stuff overseas. But whenever you would do these, they would start talking about these standby letters of credit. Or sometimes they'd just say an LC or an LOC. And I had no idea what these were. What are you talking? I didn't dare say that, though. I'll take care of that. Oh, yeah. And then I furiously, frantically, looking around, looking through my financial books, find out these are bankers' acceptances. Essentially, you don't pay or promise to pay for what you're buying. What you do is you set up a deal so that a bank promises to pay for what you're buying. Or a bank promises to deliver the funds or something else that is part of the deal. And then that way there is a confidence, there is a break between the buyer and the seller. We deal in the goods, and then there is a bank here who will make sure that the money gets there. And that means that the bank will, if I'm, let's say, buying something from overseas. In one case, I bought some Alexandrites, or I tried to. It fell through. But I was trying to buy some Alexandrites that were in Russia. Well, the thing was that the bank had stepped in. They didn't want to hear me promising, yeah, the check's in the mail. They wanted to hear something from a financial institution that said, yes, we'll pay it. That way, no problem. Deal goes through because they know they're going to get the money. The bank knows that it can extract the money from my ass if I don't pay them. So that's how it works in international trade all the time. I had no idea what these things were, these LOCs or LCs. And they had standby letters of credit too, in case I didn't pay kinds of things. So these are a way by which financial intermediaries can provide not necessarily money all the time, but a guarantee that the money will get there. So those are very short-term things because obviously these are quick transactions, sometimes less than a day, a week, a month at the worst. So that's the money market. Government borrowing money and investors coming in and lending the government money, and then the investors have these T-bills. These T-bills are as good as money. Banks have tons of these T-bills. These T-bills are used by our Federal Reserve to control monetary policy. They're part of a bank's liquidity. It's capital. negotiable CDs. Now, if you have a CD, I doubt seriously if it's anything significant. When I say negotiable CDs here, in the money markets, you're talking about monsters, huge animals. A CD of $10 million, perhaps, something along that line. You could be talking about, when I say negotiable CDs, those are big, huge animals. Not that CD that you bought, you put in a $500, or your grandma bought you a CD that matures in 3 years and you'll get $200 out when it's done. Now, I'm talking about these 800-pound gorilla behemoth CDs. Now, the other side of this is the capital markets. These are the long-term markets, the capital markets. The long-term markets, where you see the bonds, the notes, and the stock. The bonds, the notes, and the stock. Now remember how I described this. In terms of debt instruments, there are bills, notes, and bonds. Bills are 1 year or less maturity. Notes are 7 years. I've always wondered, there are different definitions. 1 to 7, 1 to 10 years, a note. And then there are bonds. They're more than 10 years. 15, 20, 30, 50, 100 years in length. The obligation can go on very long. Now, if you're an investor, well, what kind of an investor would want to invest in something where the payoff would not come for 100 years or 500 years? Would there be any reason for any investor to want something that didn't pay off for a very, very long time? Can you think of some reason, some kind of investor? What if you're an insurance company, a life insurance company? You want very long-term investments because most of the people you are insuring will live very long lives. You don't need the cash flow for a long time. Well, yeah, people don't live 100 years, though. What would that? Oh, well, there are risks out there where the probability in any given year of a disaster is very small. But over a very, very long period of time, the probability is very high. Here in this part of the country, we have a fault underneath this part of the country. It's called the New Madrid Fault. The last time that thing uncorked was hundreds of years ago, back in the time when there were only a few European explorers in this part of the country. They described the violence of that earthquake was so significant that they wrote that the Mississippi River flowed backwards. It actually didn't. A wave went up the Mississippi and came back down, looking like the river was flowing backwards. It scared the hell out of them. They never see anything like that before. But you see, can you imagine if that New Madrid Fault uncorks in our time, with all the gas lines and the oil pipelines that crisscross the country, coming right through the heartland of America? It would be absolutely unbelievably disastrous. So you would certainly want to insure against earthquakes out here, but you would, and insurance companies would be willing to insure against serious, serious dangers that were probable only over very long periods of time, but you would want matching investments that would pay off only over long periods of time. So, but anyway, look, remember, the issuer of a debt instrument is the borrower. The issuer of a debt instrument is the borrower. The buyer of the debt instrument is the lender. The lender, the buyer, pays the price, which is your loan as the issuer. When you borrow money for a house, that is a bond. You're selling a bond. A bank has underwritten, like an investment banker, the bank has underwritten that loan by guaranteeing that it will buy at the price of the house what you need to borrow. And then the bank becomes the bearer of the instrument, the bearer of the bond. Now, in this time, the bank doesn't keep that bond. It might be gone by that night. What a lot of banks do nowadays, of course, that's the secondary mortgage market. They bundle up a bunch of loans, package them, and then they just sell them right out into the secondary mortgage market to Ginnie Mae or something like that. As a matter of fact, I saw one just recently. A credit union was involved, and I went to the closing to try to pretend like I knew what I was doing. But obviously, everything was already set up and all that. And I thought, okay, the credit union is going to lend for this house. And then, obviously, the credit union will package up the loan in a few days once it's got some other home loans, and it'll sell it into a secondary mortgage market. Ah, it wasn't even the lender. It was simply acting as a representative of a secondary mortgage market investor. It was already sold before it was even the money was lent. It was being underwritten not by the bank, but by a secondary mortgage market participant. It didn't even pass through a credit union or a bank. And apparently that's actually showing up more and more, where there's not even the bank as the buyer and then selling it from as a dealer. Though in this case, the bank was simply a broker representing the buyer of the security that was being issued by the borrower for the house. I'm pouring a lot of terminology at you. One of the things that I'm going to do on Thursday is come back through this again and just ask some questions and say, all right, well, you know, let's talk about what we're doing here and what would be the scenario? Talking about broker, dealer? And I'll bring in some financial information, show you some actual quotes from bonds and stock markets. But look, let me step here in these last few minutes to the characteristics of a classic corporate bond. The characteristics of a classic corporate bond. And on Thursday, I'll talk about stocks and common versus preferred. But I want to close out here with the story of what the parameters are of a bond. First of all, every bond has a face value. That is how much the buyer of the bond will get at the maturity date of the instrument. The face value. Now, unless I say differently, corporate and government bonds have a face value of $1,000. They might have a multiple of that, 10,000, 100,000, a million. But every bond that we'll talk about, now, interestingly enough, notice that this is distinct from how mortgages that you guys would have for houses will work. Because in a mortgage, they calculate a payment, and we'll work that formula. It's really easy with calculators anymore. It wasn't easy back in the days of tables. But they calculate a payment that pays off the interest that's outstanding in a given month and shaves some off the principal so that your last payment is essentially just wiping out what's left of a little bit of principal on the house after 20, 30 years. Corporate bonds, government bonds, don't work that way. All that a corporation is paying along the way is interest on the face value. At the date of maturity, they pay one last payment, and then they pay the $1,000 face value. That's how corporate bonds work. Essentially, all along the way, all the corporation is doing is servicing the debt, servicing the interest that it has been carrying. The interest rate is called the coupon. You'll hear me call it the coupon. That is the interest per year that is going to be paid on face. So if I were to tell you an 8.5%, an IBM IBM, and this is not quite correct terminology, 25, an 8.5 IBM 25. That means if you are the bearer of that instrument, every year through the year 2025, you will get $85. 85, 8.5% of $1,000. If you're the bearer of one of those bonds, you'll get $85 a year. Now, we'll see later that they probably will divide that up into half, semi-annual, maybe quarterly payments. But all that's saying to you is that for every year for the next, 16 years, you're going to get a check for $85. In 2025, you'll get one last check for $85. Then you'll also get a check for $1,000. That's how that works. And the other thing then is the maturity. Those are the primary maturity when face is paid. Those are the core three pieces that drive the price of a bond, the value of a bond. Look, think of it this way. I mean, if IBM, if you invested in something that was similarly risky to IBM, and anything that was similarly risky to IBM debt of this kind was paying 8.5% too, then you should be willing to pay about $1,000 for this bond. It's just a normal investment. You pay $1,000, you're going to get 8.5%, $85 every year, and then you'll get your $1,000 back at the end. Now, suppose that things like IBM are paying coupons suddenly of 12%. Are you going to pay $1,000 anymore for an IBM that's paying you 8.5% if other investments just like IBM are paying 12%?
Probably.
Would you pay more or would you pay less?
Less.
Oh yeah, you'd pay less. Bite me, I'm not paying $1,000 for that thing. So you see, if the relative interest rate environment starts going up after coupon bond has been issued, well, that's going to drive down the price of that bond because investors are going to say, that sucks. On the other hand, suppose that interest rates on similarly risky instruments falls to, let's say, 5%. If you've got an 8.5% bond, oh yeah, that thing, that's valuable because you're going to hold on to that. IBM's going to say, would you like to give that back to us? No, I'm going to keep that. See, because interest rates have fallen, you got something that's paying more, you're going to keep it for a while. So if the prevailing interest rate environment is sagging, you should see all other things being constant, bond prices rising. Conversely, if you are going to see the relative interest rate environment rising, you should see bond prices beginning to fall down. Bonds that have already been issued. So, one more thing, and then I'll let this drop because I want to take time for you to have a calculator. I realize some of you probably didn't bring one. But there's one more thing, and this is something that the book doesn't mention, and I've got to talk about it just briefly, covenants. Ideally, in this class, for quite a while, I'll talk about just straight bonds, bonds that the company issues them and then pays the coupon, and then at the end it pays the $1,000. Investors buy these bonds, which means that they're lending the company money. Then the bonds trade in secondary markets like stock does. In the real world, bonds actually can carry all kinds of different complications to them. Some bonds are backed by assets of the company. Okay? Some bonds are, we would call those mortgage bonds. They're safe, very safe. You know, if you're an investor, you lend the company money, the company goes tap city, you got something, that's my building. Then there are bonds that don't have any backing. They're just what we call debentures. And you're sort of, you know, well, I hope the company doesn't go tap city because I'll be way at the back of the line waiting for my money because the secured creditors, the ones who had mortgage bonds, they'll take everything. They'll just gobble it up. That's one way you can see. Then there's another way that bonds can be divvied up in terms of who gets paid first if there's trouble. We would say there's senior and then there's junior. So these covenants can be in there and they can affect the price. Then there are two other nasty things too. One of them is called a callable bonds. Watch it. Because a callable bond, the company, say IBM, interest rates fall to 5%. If the bond is callable, IBM can simply pay your $1,000 and say, screw you. Because we can reissue the debt at 5%. You see why IBM would like to do that? Love to do that. So if you got a callable bond, that means that the company could pay you off early if it wanted to under certain conditions. That's not very cool. So you would probably, all other things being equal, want to pay a lower price for a callable bond than for a non-callable bond. And then there's one last real nasty one. I don't recommend them. Convertible bonds. You ever heard of a convertible bond? Okay. Convertible bond is one where they can actually, the company can convert it into common stock. You see, common stock, they don't ever have to pay you a dime on common stock. And if the company gets in real trouble and it's got convertibles, it can just simply convert its debt into equity, and then you're sitting there with worthless I don't want this stuff. This stuff sucks. And but they can do it if it's convertible. And so I caution you, and this is something, it was kind of like a giant hole in what they were talking about in the text, is these covenants can really affect the price of a bond, affect the value, also affect the kind of investor that would be willing to invest in the instrument. Now, a straight bond that's just a clean, let's say, a 20-year bond issued by a nice, big, creditworthy corporation, those are great investments for people who want something for their retirement. That's why I recommend, look, if you're talking about retirement income, go into a mutual fund that invests in bonds. Because, I mean, those things are just going to pay. And then when they pay off the face value, you just reinvest. And they're very safe. You don't want people who want just safe cash flow to be playing in bonds that have complicated covenants. Especially if those covenants could turn really adverse, like a convertibility covenant or something like that. Also, of course, if you want safety, you would certainly rather have a bond that had backing with collateral of the company, physical collateral, a mortgage bond. The debentures, sure, most of the time they're safe because if you're investing in a very strong creditworthy corporation, they're not going to go tap city, right? Well, be careful of that because we're seeing some pretty serious people, bonds that were assumed to be quite safe are turned out to be not nearly as safe as we thought. This economic downturn was nasty enough to take out some bonds that had decent credit ratings. So when you're investing, yes, bonds are safer than stocks, but always, always look for the covenants and always, always make sure that you understand that even with a bond, safe as it is, the company can go bankrupt and you could be out, especially if you weren't first in line with as a senior debt holder with mortgage backing. You might still be out your money, even as a lender. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.